Okay, before I mention the books that I'm recommending on this topic, I should just mention the Ben and Ina Ziegler are sponsoring this morning's breakfast. Ben's grandmother, he's not here, but if anybody sees me, let him know I mentioned it. So Ben's grandmother actually, he specifically called me last night and said that he wanted to sponsor this one about Jabotinsky, because Ben's grandmother was her family was very active in the Jewish underground in the pre-state Palestine. So when I was, just one quick story, so when I was in Israel for Nathaniel, the Ziegler's bar mitzvah, the Ziegler's son's bar mitzvah, we were there in December this past year, November, it was in November. So we were in Israel. So I went for Shabbos, and the shul that they davened in, I spent a lot of years roaming the streets in Yerushalayim, and I'd never heard of it. It's this random little shtiebel that's in Nachlaot, and this was actually a shtiebel that was just for the underground fighters in the pre-state, Yerushalayim. Fascinating place. They have all of this stuff. There's a guy that gave a tour after the davening that Shabbos morning where Nathaniel had lain, showing us all of these different places where they used to hide all of their weapons caches, and how the bima was built as a trap door, so that he showed me this, that you actually would open up the trap door and somebody would climb in, and they couldn't just put it right there because the British would have found it. This is all trying to evade the British soldiers who were policing Palestine at the time. So there was a little crevice, there was a little trap door that led to a tunnel, and you had to go through the tunnel, which is why anytime any of the underground fighters needed to go on a mission, they would have to bring a kid with them, because you needed a kid to be able to climb in there and actually gather all of these weapons. And this like trap door is still there. And the Freda Bat Yehuda Leib, who the shir this morning is in memory of, her name's on the wall of this shul, because her family was very involved. And this is still like a hot spot for children and grandchildren and friends of people that were in that era. So even though what I'd like to focus on today, which we'll get to in a second, is even though if we look at the political landscape of the State of Israel today and the political landscape of how the State of Israel is reported, somebody like Jabotinsky and certainly his acolytes and certainly the people that claim to be the inheritors of his legacy, those are not people that are usually smiled upon by a large segment of the Israeli population. And it's certainly, with the press, which has, somewhat of a different political leaning, very often this is the type of thing that is, presented pejoratively, presented negatively. What I'd like to do today, and again, I'm sorry that we're not going to have the text that we usually do in order to make my case, but what I'd like to do today is go through the story of Jabotinsky, go through his life, which actually was cut very, very short, and through that prism, I would like to, I hope, open up our eyes to see how somebody like Jabotinsky, when we don't know much about him, is seen as this radical, right? I imagine, I didn't poll the crowd, but I imagine if I were to ask you one word to describe Jabotinsky, if anybody that knows anything about him, would radical be in the top three?
The name of the street.
The name of the street? Excellent, Rabbi Berman. The name of the street probably is another good choice. But what I would like, the image that I would like to depict today, and certainly the image that I've gotten, the more that I've read, the more that I've learned, the more that I've studied about Jabotinsky, the more that this image has really come into full force, is the person, is the one who's really an intellectual, really a thinker, and unlike many of the other founders in the founders of the State of Israel that we'll be discussing, he was actually a prolific writer. Ben-Gurion, I'll just give one anecdote about Ben-Gurion, for comparison's sake. I only have one left, so we have one more for Ben. Ben Yashkoach for sponsoring. I spoke about your grandmother in one of the stories that we got from the bar mitzvah and the shul. So it was really in her zchut that we're specifically studying Jabotinsky today. It's very special. Her neshama should have an aliyah. Okay, so just by contrast, Ben-Gurion, after he retired, so he was retired for a good 15 years, and he moved down to the Negev, to the Stavo Care, which was a little moshav, a little yeshuv in the Negev. Ben-Gurion was trying to encourage people to settle the Negev more. So his project, he stated in interviews and in a bunch of places, many, many times, that his project, that he wanted to spend his years in retirement writing the history of Israel from his perspective. Ben-Gurion was just not a talented writer. He wasn't a writer at all. I would even argue his strength was not even as a political thinker, which we'll talk more about when we're gonna get to him. I would argue that Ben-Gurion's greatest strength, which is probably what the country needed most, was his political know-how and his just sheer tenacity. His willingness to stand up in a given situation and do what has to get done, despite the unimaginable pressures that were on him. Jabotinsky really couldn't be more couldn't be more different. Really the polar opposite of somebody like Ben-Gurion. And it's not surprising that in the end they actually were you know, really terrible, terrible political enemies, which we'll get to as well. Jabotinsky wasn't tenacious. He couldn't do, you'll see as we go through his story, he couldn't stay in one place for more than 5 minutes. Of the part of his history that you'll see, he's switching from this place to that place. He holds jobs for 6 months at a time, 8 months at a time. He gets started on this Zionist project and this Zionist project. He's working on this, he's working on this. But he almost had what today we would probably call ADHD, you know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Somebody, the inability to stay focused on one thing, something that he actually highlights about his own upbringing and his own education. But Jabotinsky was also somebody who was a deep, profound thinker and a writer. And he was a poet, and he was a playwright, and he was an essayist, and he was a novelist. And so much of this played out. One of the greatest resources that we have for studying Jabotinsky is the fact that he did so many novels set in places that he was at particular time periods that he was. So he grew up in Odessa, and one of the best we'll start with Odessa in one minute. But one of the, just as a nugget, which we'll get to, one of the best sources that we have for what life and his experience was in Odessa was not personal recollections as much as technically fictional stories, which were clearly about himself. They were clearly autobiographical, and he's really just describing events that he experienced. He was your consummate, you know, college dropout, but who was too smart for his own good. And he his entire life was lived in that respect. So who was this guy? Who was Vladimir Jabotinsky? Where did he come from? How did he get started and on the scene? Where did the Zionism come from? And how did he wind up being the ideological figurehead of what was then known as revisionist Zionism? We'll talk about where that name comes from. What was known as revisionist Zionism and what really came to be known today, you know, and maybe we'll discuss whether or not that's fair or not, but today what came to be known as the political right in the state of Israel, and the Zionistic political right. So that's that's the overarching question. Who was Jabotinsky? Where does he fit? And is the moniker of being the father of the political right, the Zionist political right, is that actually sensible? So he was born in 1880 in Odessa. He was born to two parents who were, this was the, you know, typical of late 19th century when assimilation was becoming more and more of a thing, you know, as the Enlightenment was fully underway for about a century. So he had so Jabotinsky was born to two parents. His mother was, he writes, was observant her entire life. She kept a kosher home and lit Shabbos candles. Jabotinsky even had a Hebrew tutor when he was growing up, but he had no formal Jewish education. He grew up in Odessa. Before we describe Odessa in Jabotinsky's life, it's important to understand the state of Jewish life in Russia in the 19th century. Right, what do we know? Where did Jews live? What part of Russia did they live in? Anybody know the term? The Pale of the Settlement, right. So the Pale of the Settlement. So in 1783, a young John Quincy Adams, who was eventually going to be the sixth president of the United States, John Quincy Adams goes with a guy named Francis Dana, who is a, all right, I'm going to make this relevant to the United States of America also. Francis Dana, who actually went to France in a few years earlier to be his father, John Quincy Adams' father, John Adams Sr., his secretary. He's there in France. He's the representative of what was even before the Constitution was established in the Confederation Congress. He was the Confederation Congress's representative. John Quincy Adams is there. Dana gets appointed to be the minister, the United States' minister to the court of Catherine the Great in St. Petersburg. And he goes, and he's appointed, but he needs a secretary because he doesn't speak a lick of French, and John Quincy Adams is fluent in French, so Francis Dana takes John Quincy Adams with him. Their mission is actually a colossal failure. They stay for 2 years and never even get recognized by Catherine the Great. Okay. Fast forward a few years, actually it has nothing to do with John Quincy Adams, but maybe he had some type of influence on Catherine the Great. Because only a few years later, in 1791, after the Polish liberation and the annexation of territories, of Polish territories to Russia, the Pale of Settlements is established. It's pretty much one of the more anti-Semitic things that's happened in our history. The Empress of Russia, right? The dictatorial leader of Russia decides, I don't want Jews living anywhere here, anywhere near us. So we're going to designate a part of our territory, and the Jews are only allowed to go there. And the effect of this was fascinating. So much of Eastern European culture, so much of the shtetl that developed in that century, in this, you know, from 1791 and throughout the 19th century, was a big function of the fact that the Jews were living in such close quarters. The assimilation process might have started much earlier if Jews were allowed into the big cities, but they were not. In Russia, they were not allowed to the big cities. They were stuck. They were forced to live in the Pale of Settlement. I have a map on the right over here, so you'll see. So this is, I don't know if you recognize the territory, but this is the Black Sea, and which leads to the Mediterranean. So this is the Western Russia. Right, so this is Western Russia in what is now today Belarus and Ukraine. And if you you probably can't, I put the thumbnail too small, but if you look close enough, you'll start recognizing. Right now, maybe I'll expand it when I put the version online. These are all the names of the shtetlach and the areas and the towns that our grandparents are from, and you start to recognize them. It's also the names of several Hasidic sects that you know, were spawned from there, from these areas. All of that is because St. Catherine, or Dr. Katz, as I write about Francis Dana and John Quincy Adams, I should have asked you before. Okay. So, okay, good. I'm glad I didn't get that wrong. All of this was born out of the decision to stick all of the Jews in the Pale of Settlement. There was one exception. There was one exception, possibly two, but we're not gonna talk about Warsaw right now. Warsaw is probably the only other exception. Other than Warsaw, there was only one city in the entire Russian territory, in the entire Russia, that Jews were allowed into. And that was Odessa. Because of that, Odessa was a completely unique situation. A completely unparalleled, with the exception of Warsaw, a completely unparalleled type of place for a Jew to be. Why is that? All right, and it's really just very, very stark when you compare it to the type of Jews that were living in the shtetl in the rest of the territory that Jews were living. Okay, but as another illustration of how the Pale of Settlement was concentrated with Jews, so you look, this is the Pale of Settlement, the red over here. The darker the red, the higher the percentage of Jews were, and this was from a census in 1905, and when you get to the beige over here, the Jewish population was zero. I mean, that's a very, very stark... And Russia keeps going, right, to the end of the page. So this is a very, very serious thing, that the Jews were all concentrated in this one spot.
Wasn't Russia a-religious? So why did they...
At this stage, it was not. The Russian Revolution doesn't happen for... Jabotinsky is born in 1880. The Russian Revolution doesn't really start happening until 1905, and that's when Lenin and his comrades, and the rise of communism, and the rise of Marxism, and the anti-religious movements that happened in Europe and Asia, that like all of that was going on in the first decades of the 20th century. When Jabotinsky is growing up in the 1880s and the 1890s, this is still for all intents and purposes, Russian Orthodoxy was still the state-run religion. Okay, so. And that's an important point. So he's growing up. So Jabotinsky's growing up in Odessa, and Odessa is the one place at this stage in history where a Jew can live in a city, in an actual city, and be exposed to the types of things that people are exposed to in a big city: the culture, the literature, the artistry. He becomes an artist and a journalist and a playwright, and not a rebbe and a cheder, because this was the place that he was from. He was able to live in a home, all right. And when I say able, I say not necessarily a good thing, obviously from our perspective. But he was able to live in a home where the paramount concern was not religious observance, because he was not in the shtetl and he didn't have the social isolation factor of the shtetl. And Jabotinsky talks about his youth, about how he was aware of his Judaism, and he was aware of, obviously, it was a part of his identity, but it was by no means an exclusive part of his identity. And I think that we, in our own upbringing, in 20th century America, where we all grew up, I think that actually this part of it can resonate with us much more than it can with our parents. Right? We can understand this idea that there's different forces competing for a person's identity, right? Because this is the world in which we grew up in. We are Jewish, and it is for most of us it is the defining characteristic of our identity. But if you were an inquisitive young student, if you were living in a world of culture, if you're living in a world and you have all these other interests, and these are the types of things that are pulling at you. So he was living a typical life that I think is very relatable for us, one in which he had an endless array of interests, but also this Jewish identity. That's before we even say a word about anti-Semitism. Just the fact that he grew up in a home, right, but in which the fact that he was Jewish meant something, coupled with the fact that he grew up in a city where there was a huge, huge cultural presence. Those are poles that tugged on him. And at different parts of Jabotinsky's life, parts of these are dormant and other parts are not. So he lives for the first 17 years of his life in Odessa. I mentioned that he's the type of kid that seems like, he has attention issues. This is a description of that he writes to a letter of somebody else. And again, I'm sorry, this is a couple of the only texts that we actually have. I've seen children, this is the first source on the first page in the middle. I've seen children who love their schools. I envy them, but to tell the truth, I understand them no more than a blind man understands what sunlight looks like. And when I work with kids with ADHD, by the way, this is a very, very typical description that they would give. All right? Kids who are bright, kids who have very, very high cognitive skills, who can do incredible things if we accommodate, a few things here and there for this difficulty that they have. But that was Jabotinsky to a T. He was a brilliant, precocious kid who was inquisitive and interested in so many different things, but he just didn't understand the idea of being studious. He couldn't sit still. So no more the blind man understands what sunlight looks like. The end of line number 3. To this day, my instinct, which no other father would probably admit to, he's talking as a father here, which no other father would probably admit to, is to hate good students, those that always do their homework. The only kind I've ever loved were the mischief makers. All right, so he doesn't say that this is an autobiographical sketch, but I would argue, all right, and for anybody who's ever had a kid who has a little bit of trouble in school, I imagine that this is something that is resonant. So he's not making an autobiographical sketch, but I think that, if we're reading this, it's clear to us that he's describing something that is very, very relatable to him. Right? He never understood being a studious person. He never understood sitting and cramming for exams. He never understood sitting in class and being the obedient kid. He was the troublemaker, but he was probably too smart for his own good. And in fact, he was a precocious kid. So, I'm just going to say with 2 more words about the first stage of his life. Right? So he lives for 17 years in Odessa, in this area in which he's culturally very interested, terribly unstudious, but remains in school and lives in a home. The other component that's really important to this, and this is a extremely traumatic event for a kid to experience, especially when you're from a family without much means. His father dies when he's 6 years old. His father dies when he's 6 years old, and his father was, of course, the only breadwinner in the family. His father was away on business. He was in Germany. He got sick and died. And one of Jabotinsky's biographers actually contends that one of Jabotinsky's part of his visceral hatred for Germany, for the lifelong, I think it's a little Freudian to say this, but part of his visceral hatred, his knee-jerk hatred for Germany for the rest of his life, has to do with the fact that he was, already as a 6-year-old, he almost blamed Germany. This is what a 6-year-old would do. He blames Germany for killing his father. So before I mention this at the outset, Hillel Halkin wrote this biography of Jabotinsky a few years ago. Magnificent, magnificent. It's a really, really, I can't recommend it enough. It reads like a thriller, and I can't recommend it enough. The other text that I use primarily to prepare this, which you're not actually going to read any of the text, unfortunately, but this is Jabotinsky's memoirs that was republished by an academic version. It was retranslated and re-edited put together. This is a really important primary text for reading Jabotinsky. It's only about 100 pages long, but this was later in life, and he actually went back and wrote about a lot of the earlier stages. So when you're talking about biography and autobiography, like, that's of questionable value in terms of historical fact, but it is a very important window into Jabotinsky's mindset. One of the advantages of somebody who writes a lot is that there's a lot of material for a historian to work with. So Jabotinsky in his lifetime wrote thousands of letters. It had to have been hundreds and hundreds of newspaper columns in which he was reporting. All right, we'll get into his journalism career in a minute. He wrote books and short stories and poems, and so many of them reference historical events. So there's tons of material to draw from in terms of trying to understand who this guy was. Okay, so his father dies when he's 6 years old. He goes through school. His mother struggles to make ends meet. They have to rely on some family members, but he ends up needing to be reliant in a way that was very unbecoming in his mind for a long period of time when he was growing up. Something that he took great pains to avoid. As a matter of fact, there's one point in his actual adult life. He ends up getting married and having one son. The one point in his life where he actually is having struggles to support his family, it has a huge amount of guilt, that he feels, more so than what we might think is normal. Probably, I would say again, has some resonance because of his experience as a child. So he spent 17 years. He's a terribly unstudious kid. He's very interested and precocious, but he doesn't do well in school. So then he pulls a move that this is the type of thing that you can only do when you're finally 17 and your dad's gone, and now you're actually physically larger than your mother, and she's no longer able to restrain you. All right, try and picture the scene. He gets up when he has got only a few months left to graduate high school. Only a few months left. He drops out of school. Okay, so you'd think that that's a little bit of a crazy thing to do. And it was crazy, but this is I'm trying to depict the person who is kind of rudderless, right? Both because he has this difficulty with, being a studious kid, and because he's too smart for his own good, but also because he doesn't have a father to guide him there, and there's only so much that a mother can do when you have a boisterous and very active kid. So he gets to 17. Why does he leave? He's writing throughout his high school, what would be for us his high school years, and whatever the grade school or gymnasium or whatever it was called in Russia. So he starts writing really as a 12-year-old, and he's active in his journalism career already as a teenager, and he gets offered a job as a foreign correspondent for an Odessa newspaper that he's already writing for, to go to Bern, Switzerland. Okay, so that's what so he jumps at the opportunity. It was his first opportunity to get away from home. So try and think of the kid. Again, this is not a foreign story for us. I think so much of this is relatable for us. Try and think of the kid who grows up in a broken home and is, never really able to get over this traumatic event of his youth, and is too smart for his own good, and never really fit in school, and has got all this stuff going on in his head, and then he hits adolescence, and now all of a sudden he gets the opportunity to leave home and go somewhere else. So he jumps at it. And what his mom felt about him leaving school, we don't know. He ended up being, obviously, those last few months didn't really hurt him. But the fact that he took this unconventional route, I think, probably has a lot to do with not just his Odessa upbringing, but also the fact that he grew up in the home that he grew up in. For the first 17 years of his life, his Judaism, I would say, is in a significant part of his character, but it's dormant. It doesn't really have, it's not the prominent part of his life. And like I said, I think that the best way for us to understand it would be this idea of competing values tugging at him, competing values trying to figure out what exactly, how this person was actually wants to identify himself. Finally, he has this opportunity, and this is basically the point in his life where he pretty much, for the one period in his life where he pretty much chucks out the Jewish part of his identity, and for the next 3 years, if you read through his correspondence, again, I'm going mostly on secondary literature that I'm reading here, but if you read through stuff that he wrote during those years and stuff that he reminisced about those years, the years that he spends, the next 3 years that he spends away, starting with 1897 when he leaves Odessa, you get the feeling that he never even spoke to a Jew. Almost the fact that he was ignorant of the fact that Rome had a vibrant Jewish community. Rome. So he goes to Bern. He never really wants to be in Bern. He's in Bern for a short period of time, and then finagles his way into being this paper that he's working for in Odessa. He finagles his way into being the foreign correspondent in Rome rather than in Bern. So the first thing that he does, the way Halkin put it, is the first thing that he does is that he leaves Russia, and then the next stage that he really needed to do is that he needed to get away from Russians. So first he needed to get away from Russia, then he needed to get away from Russians. So he goes from, I have the map here. So I referenced just a hodgepodge of places that he was at that were significant periods. So first of all, the guy got around. I think that's actually something that we can appreciate just by looking at the map. And most of these places, all but like three or four of these places, he actually lived for a significant period of time. So Dean and I are on our third home right now, and we're already talking about how we're planning to move again in the summer, and I can't believe that we're ever going to have to do it again. This guy had like 15 homes, and those are just the ones that I put on here. He had a whole bunch more. He got around a lot. So I'm not kidding when I said that he was jumping all over the place. So he was from Odessa, which is right here on the coast of the Black Sea, what is it now in modern-day Ukraine. Okay, but it was it was part of Russia back then. And he moved to Bern, over here, right? So it's all the way in Western Europe in Bern. And then he stays in Bern for a short period, and I didn't mark Rome, but Rome is down here on the Italian peninsula. So he goes down to Rome. So that's his trajectory. He stays in Rome, all right? And this is part of the same picture of the 17-year-old lousy student. His intention, right, and the justification for leaving Bern to go to Rome is that he's going to study law there. So he enrolls in a law school in Rome, this famous law school in Rome, and he's enrolled there for 3 semesters, and the historians have dug up a transcript of his from the 3 semesters. It said that he was enrolled over the course of the 3 semesters in a total of something like 8 classes. He very rarely attended, and he failed every single one. All right? So think. So one of the things that is really a sign of not just his precociousness but his brilliance. He had a knack for languages. By the end, I made a list of them. By the end of his career, he had mastered. And when I say mastered, I mean fluent as a native in that land and of that, as a native of that language, and even was writing professionally in the following languages: Russian, Italian, Yiddish, German, Hebrew, French, English, and Polish. All of them. There are testimonials of people that knew him in the different stages of his life. And every single one of those languages, he spoke like a native. Like, you couldn't tell. Not only that, they say he's only 3 years in Rome, and he not only, I don't know if anybody here speak Italian? All right. So apparently, the people that speak Italian tell me this. There are different dialects of Italian. Whether you're from, the up country or the low country or the, obviously it doesn't make any difference to us. But testimonials of Jabotinsky, contemporaneous of this time that he was in Italy, talk about how he not only spoke a fluent Italian and sounded like he was a native, but he was so good at it that he was able to make any part, any dialect, think that he was a native of that dialect. He was a master with languages. He went at several points in the story that we're telling. He goes to a new country and a new culture and a new language and picks up the language like that, and within a few months is talking, conversing, interviewing, and writing and publishing in that native language. It's fascinating. He grew up speaking Russian with a small smattering of Yiddish. And pretty much it. And he was able, and the idea that he would go to Rome so confident in this, I think, is already, again, a testament to the fact that he didn't have any qualms with picking up a new language. I think for us, the big joke is that everybody says about what do you call the guy who's bilingual? That's the guy who speaks 2 languages. What do you call the guy who's trilingual? Somebody who speaks 3 languages. What do you call the person that's monolingual? That's American. Right? Yeah. We have the good fortune of being residents of this beautiful country, and we can go touring in Europe and usually get around. Dina and I were, whatever. The same story that I'm sure all of you have. Okay. So, Jabotinsky is in Rome writing and working as a journalist. He's able to support himself on a lousy salary because he's a bachelor living in Rome, and he has no incentive. He pays the bills. He lives the nightlife. Picture a 19-year-old kid who has got no business leaving home and going off to college. Going home and going off to college. This is a story that happens every single day, right? And you immediately start getting involved in all the things that people who have no interest in going to class get involved in. And that's what he was doing. And this is the point in his life, the period in his life, where there is virtually no mention in his writings, in his reminiscences of this period, about Judaism, certainly not Zionism, with one exception. And it's not a primary source. It's a secondary. It's not a first-hand account. It's not something that he wrote. But there's a person, right, one of his correspondents, talks about how reports that Jabotinsky told him during his stay in Italy. He met several times with a guy named Yosef Marco Baruch, or Baruch. I'm assuming it was Baruch in Italian. I'm assuming we haven't heard of this guy. He died in 1897. But he was, all right, and as Zionism was unfolding in the end of the 19th century era, we're most familiar with it with Herzl, but Herzl didn't publish Der Judenstaat until, right, The Jewish State, his book that kind of launched his career in Zionism, all right, which led to the Zionist Congress, the first Zionist Congress in 1897 in Basel. So Herzl didn't do that until the mid-1890s. 1896 was when he wrote it in 1895. Der Judenstaat was published in 1896. Already for decades beforehand, and last year when we were working on the Zionism, the one that was just the general topic of Zionism, we were speaking about some of these people. There were people that were advocating new forms of modern Zionism decades before Herzl. Herzl's greatness was in a different area. He was the political thinker. He was the strategist. He was the one who actually had a plan. He was a master orator, and he was able to gather people together and marshal people united to one cause. None of that is a small thing. But there were thinkers that were publishing and writing and advocating already. This guy, Yosef Marko Baruch, who, again, we don't have Jabotinsky reporting that he met him, but we have a guy reporting that Jabotinsky said that he met him. This guy was known as he was inspired by Garibaldi. Right, he thought, and you'll see why in a second, that this is important for Jabotinsky. He thought that the most important thing that Zionism could do is develop a Jewish army to conquer Palestine. Right, that's the most important cause for Zionism. We can theorize all we want. We can make all of the congresses that we want. We can try and entreat to the Turkish Sultan all we want. We can work with Britain. We can work with France. We can work with Germany. The best thing that we could do, the most important thing that we could do, is actually create a Jewish army. The reason why this is so important is because what will probably be the defining effort of Jabotinsky's career, I would argue, even more than Beitar, and even more, the thing that he did most to contribute to the cause, which I think everybody would agree to, the other stuff people will debate on. The thing that I think everybody would agree to is that he was the one screaming loudest and most effectively for the formation of a Jewish army, or a Jewish battalion of Jewish soldiers to be stationed in Palestine during World War I. A fascinating story, which we'll get to in detail in a few short moments. Okay, so he's in Rome for these 3 years. He, again, publishing constantly. His vocation is to write. He stays up, right? He's a college kid, he stays up all night, you know, sleeps till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, wakes up, he goes and reports on some event that's going on in Rome, and he's wildly popular by his newspaper in Odessa. Again, he's the foreign correspondent. So he writes, sends articles, they publish them, and his articles apparently in Odessa, where this paper is being published, are extremely, extremely well received. Everybody loves him. This guy is not, like I said, he's a magnificent, he's a talented writer. There are people there are literature people that make the argument, that say that Tolstoy had nothing on Vladimir Jabotinsky. If you want to talk about Russian authors, people that have, that at the very least he belongs up there with them. The fact that one of the literature people would say that the tragedy of his career is that he left writing, or left so much of his, of his talent, of his, by the wayside to engage in Zionist activity. But the fact that as an 18-year-old who was probably drinking and boozing and not doing a lot of things that were, beatnik type of behavior, and not engaging in, he wasn't like sitting and working on this stuff all day, and he was still writing at such a quality that he was recognized in the city, in Odessa, in a big city, for his writing, is already, again, another testament to just how talented of a person, of an author, of a writer, and a thinker that he was. It's not, good journalism is not just, and it's hard to find sometimes, but good journalism is not just a question of good writing, it's also a question of taking the pieces of a particular thing that you're reporting on, and, not just telling the right story, but telling the right parts of the right story. Apparently he was excellent. How do we know? Because in 1901 he goes home. He's planning to just go home for a short vacation for the summer, and he ends up getting an offer from the paper. He checks in with the office when he goes home to visit his mother. He checks in with the office that's paying him, and they offer him a full-time position that pays really well. So that was an offer that he couldn't refuse. And even though he, for the rest of his life, will refer back to his years in Rome as being the most enjoyable and most rewarding and most fulfilling years of his life. Again, I take that less seriously when I read it in his memoirs, because I think that every college kid talks about those years of his life that way, regardless of how they are important, but they're not necessarily like objectively important. I would argue that those years probably weren't as profound as he might have seen them to be. But at the same time, he looked at that period in his life when he knew no happiness and no peace and tranquility in the first 17 years. He always looked at that period as the greatest period, place in which he knew the most peace and knew the most happiness. So in 1901, he moves back to Odessa for what will end up being the last short period of his life, and he never really is in the city again for the rest of his life. So the city of his birth, he comes back to. Okay, why do I mention this? Because in 1880, what happens? Right, we're talking about Zionism right now. In 1880, what starts to happen in Russia? Pogroms. The pogroms start happening in 1881, and that's when the first wave of Aliyah, the first real mass emigration from Russia, starts to happen. People go three places, all right? The two places in Europe that, I should say, not in Europe, the two places in the West that are known to welcome Jews with open arms and not discriminate against them, which were U.S. and? Yeah, what was the other country other than the U.S.? Great Britain. Great Britain. England. So the huge, tens of thousands of people. Most of our grandparents, all right, probably came later than that. But any of our grandparents that didn't come, like my mother's parents came pre-World War, you know, in the interwar period. My father's parents were born here. Anybody is of that era who was born here, their parents are, you know, or you started coming in that period. In the pre-1920s period, where before the immigration laws were passed by Congress for, that's actually a really interesting parsha in the history of psychology, but obviously not for now. Before those laws were passed, when the doors were open, give me your tired, your poor, your tempest tossed, right? In the words, in the immortal words etched in the Statue of Liberty, that's when the Jews started coming, and the floodgates opened. By the Civil War, Dr. Katz, help me out on this, if you know. In the Civil War, the Jewish population in the country was numbering in the tens of thousands. By the time that they closed the gates in the 1920s, we were something like 2 million. So we're talking a period of 60, 70 years, and do the math, how much the Jewish population. So it just gives you a sense of how much, you know, the Jews are on the move at this stage in history. This is from the 1860s to the 1920s. Huge, huge mass immigration. So other than Jews going to the U.S. and Jews going to Britain, the other thing that really happens is that the organized movement for Zionism and for people to emigrate to the land of Israel, to what was then Ottoman Palestine, really starts to take tremendous shape. So, with that, with those next intervening, you know, those next decades after following the 1880s, things actually start to get worse. There's blood libels and there's pogroms and it gets terrible. And what ends up starting to happen is that as, you know, things are bad for a whole bunch of reasons in Europe, and this is the way anti-Semitism usually works. The Jews, even though, like the Jews in the shtetl, who were just the shtetl that my grandparents were from, it was a wood production industry over there. It was a huge forest industry in northern Romania, and the biggest industry in the area where most of the Jews were employed was in chopping down wood and being a lumber supplier. How that could be like a Protocols of Elders of Zion trying to take over the world, you know, the world economy is silly, but that's the type of mentality that people actually had. So that type of anti-Semitism, people start blaming the Jews for all of the problems in the world. That's what's leading to these pogroms. The Jews, who nobody knows, nobody has, other than in places like Odessa, right? Nobody knows, nobody lives next to, nobody actually can relate to. They just know them as the people that live in that town. I deliver my milk there. They're all a bunch of crazies. And you know what? They even they murder Christian children to bake their matzah. And people start to buy this stuff because nobody actually knows Jews, right? If any of the our next door neighbors who are not Jewish were told that that person was told that we bake matzo with Christian's blood, they would laugh it off and say, no, I know the Kurzmans, they're nice people, and I've never seen any dead babies. At the very least, I've never seen any dead babies in their kitchen. So, right, we know that that's that type of thing that was actually being said on a daily basis. So that's what's going on. So this is the last source that I actually have to read here is something that he wrote about Odessa finally being hit by anti-Semitism. It became uncomfortable in Odessa. I had trouble, again, think about, this is the type of place that he grew up in, which was unlike most other cities in Europe that actually had a functioning community of Jews and non-Jews and a whole bunch of different ethnicities. Everybody got along. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in a short span of time, Jews started getting singled out for persecution. It became uncomfortable in Odessa. I had trouble recognizing our city, which only a short while ago had been so free and easy and good-natured. Now it was swept by a malice that, they say, had never previously affected our mild southern metropolis. Created over the centuries through the loving and harmonious efforts of peaceful races, there had never been any ferocious, authentic hostility. Now all this had changed. Odessa was starting to see real anti-Semitism. And this is when it climaxed in the Kishinev pogrom. Okay, and the sequence of events here is fascinating in the way they put Jabotinsky's career on a trajectory. You've heard of the Kishinev pogrom? The Kishinev pogrom was a particularly brutal pogrom that happened in 1903. One of the reasons why we know it to be particularly brutal, right? I mean, the numbers were terrible. You know, 50 people dead, you know, hundreds wounded, 1,500 Jewish shops and places of business and homes that were ransacked or destroyed. I mean, terrible. But what was one of the things that was unique to the Kishinev pogrom that happened in 1903 is, first of all, if you look at where Kishinev is on the map, so you see it's in the general region of Odessa, about 150 miles away. Right? Kishinev also started from a blood libel from some kid who was found dead. This kid was found dead something like 20 kilometers north of Kishinev. The police investigation afterwards obviously uncovered that it was his uncle that killed him, and not the Jews to use his blood to bake matzah. But the Kishinev pogrom happens. The thing that's unique about Kishinev is that Chaim Nachman Bialik, the famed poet and Jewish writer, right? And Chaim Nachman Bialik is really one of the most famous Jews in the world at this period in time, at the turn of the 20th century. Chaim Nachman Bialik is in Kishinev for this pogrom and witnesses it. And unlike any other writing, or not completely unlike, but what is not in the pattern of any other writing post these types of tragedies that take place, Bialik writes in this a very famous poem called "In the City of Slaughter." But he wrote it in Hebrew, but Ha'ir Ha'Hariga, the city of death, the city of murder, city of slaughter. And he writes in this poem it's not a kina. It's not lamenting the tragedy of the death and destruction that took place, the baseless and senseless anti-Semitism that was on display. That's not what he writes about. He writes about looking at all the Jews. We're talking about tens of thousands of Jews that are living in Kishinev right now. I wrote down the population statistics. 1 second. By 1880, all right, this is by 1880. This is 23 years before Kishinev. The Odessa had 75,000 Jews, and they numbered 25% of the population. Okay, so that is crazy. That is crazy. And what the significance of the size of their population in the city. And I'm sorry, I just gave you the numbers for Odessa, not for Kishinev. Forget that. That point, please strike that point from the record. So Bialik writes about Kishinev, about what he's so disgusted about is that he's watching all these Jews cower under their tables. You know, and ineffectively, by the way, because they're getting killed and ransacked anyway. He's watching them cower under their tables, and the cowardice, the fear, the inaction in a place where you are a huge, huge segment of the population to not gather around and actually defend yourself and stand up and be a man. You're getting killed anyway. Why do you not stand up and be a man? I had a section of the poem here that was one of the casualties of the computer program, but I'll put it on the sheet. If you read, it's really a gut-wrenching poem. You should, if you can, you should read it in the original Hebrew, but I have an excellent English translation that you could read as well. Okay, where's Jabotinsky fall into all this? So not only Odessa is pretty close to Kishinev. They had a lot of refugees from Kishinev that wound up in Odessa. So he was firstly seeing this firsthand. But then Chaim Nachman Bialik, who is, again, you know, I would say, if we're going to think of Jabotinsky in this caliber of author, of writer, so he belongs in the same discussion as Chaim Nachman Bialik. Chaim Nachman Bialik's story, we're not going to get into it, but he grew up in the shtetl. He was a student in Volozhin. He was a student of the Netziv, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and who spoke glowingly about him. He was apparently a magnificent Talmud Chacham. Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, everybody here of the Torah Tumimah commentary? On the Torah Tumimah is a commentary on the Torah. Baruch Levi Epstein was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. These are two of the most important rabbis of the 20th century. The Baruch Levi and Rav Yechiel Michal Levi Epstein, who was his father. Baruch Levi Epstein writes a 4-volume autobiography, which is one of the more fascinating pieces of writing that I've ever gone through. It's fascinating. We're not getting into it right now. And Chaim Nachman Bialik writes an approbation that's published in this famed rabbi's work. He was a student, Chaim Nachman Bialik, in Volozhin with Epstein, and they got along swimmingly, and he actually goes to this guy whose observance at this point was seriously questionable. Bialik was a very important guy, and he was able to touch religious and non-religious alike. He writes this poem. Jabotinsky comes in, reads the poem, obviously he's very moved, and what he does, which probably vaults his career, maybe more than anything else, right, he puts him on his trajectory, is that he translates the poem into Russian. What ends up happening, even though he's a prolific writer himself already at this stage, he's young, he's 23, but he's a prolific writer already at this stage, he writes his translation, and that is when his, you know, in our terminology today, that's when his fame goes viral. This translation that he makes, there was a much more of a market to read a poem about Jewish destruction in Russian than there was in Hebrew. So Jabotinsky overnight becomes a celebrity. Why is that significant? Because that happened in April of 1903, was the Kishinev pogrom. A few months later, in August of 1903, is the Sixth Zionist Congress. 1896, right? So it started in 1897, and they had one every single year until from 1897 on. Herzl, this is the last one. Herzl organizes the Zionist Congress every single year, and this is the last one that Herzl's actually in attendance for, because he dies the following year from heart failure. Herzl's career as marshaling the Jewish people and starting this is a wild success. Herzl's goal of actually achieving some type of diplomatic victory for Zionism is the one non-failure that he had, which really many there and now still would argue is a failure, happens at the Sixth Zionist Congress. And at the Sixth Zionist Congress, because he now is becoming this very famous writer because of this translation of Bialik's poem, he gets appointed as the representative from Odessa to the Sixth Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. So now Jabotinsky, who is a tacit interest in Zionism from childhood, but is obviously, he spent his years in Rome and is wavering in terms of his commitments to even his own Judaism, let alone Zionism. He's not even remotely observant. There's nothing about the man that we would call in our own vernacular today observant. But he identifies as a Jew, and Kishinev was very, very, had a very, very powerful impact on him. And he now he attends the Zionist Congress. Sixth Zionist Congress is very interesting because in the lead up to the Sixth Zionist Congress, there was what was known as the El Arish Plan. Has anybody here ever heard of the El Arish Plan? The El Arish Plan. Most people here are familiar not with the El Arish plan. Most people are familiar, what was the plan that everybody knows about?
Uganda.
Uganda ends up being on the agenda in the Sixth Zionist Congress, but it was supposed to be on the agenda was the El Arish plan. The plan was, El Arish, you can see on your map down here, El Arish is in the Sinai Peninsula on the Mediterranean coast. See? So it's in what is today, Egypt. It's on the Sinai Peninsula. The plan was that this was a completely uninhabited land. They were going to use all of their technological know-how to irrigate this desert and basically get a secure Jewish homeland from the Ottoman, from Britain, from Great Britain in this area. And the thought was, Herzl said, look, We have pogroms going on. 4 months ago was the Kishinev pogrom. We need to get these Jews out. It was becoming more and more pressing. This is not a theoretical interest anymore. This is extremely significant. This is life and death over here. We need somewhere for these people to go. So what can we do? What should we do? What is the option? So the big plan was that they were going to entreat with the British Empire to give them this territory, which is adjacent to biblical Israel. And the reason why Herzl thought he was going to be able to sell it on the Congress was that it's not like Uganda. This is an area that eventually, as it expands, hopefully will expand to what is next door, which actually is ancestral biblical Israel. That was the plan for El Arish. El Arish is flames out before it even gets started. The British are not even remotely interested in the El Arish plan, and it fizzles out. So everybody comes to the Sixth Zionist Congress expecting to hear about El Arish, and in the end, what Herzl proposes is the infamous Uganda plan. So he was actually expecting, Herzl didn't want to vote on the plan. What he wanted to vote on was to send a delegation to the area that the British had designated. Now, when I say that this is a victory for him, Zionism right now, political Zionism is 6 years old. And when 6 years old, again, think about Jewish life with the Kishinev pogrom. Think that was Jewish life until this point. Now, at this point, after only 6 years, Herzl achieves a victory that he's able to actually get the biggest and most powerful empire on planet Earth to not only recognize the movement, but actually to carve off some of its own territory for settlement for his movement. Now, if we all decided that we wanted to make a Young Israel Jamaica States colonization effort, and we decided that we want somewhere, and we went to the British Empire, or we decided that we want the U.S. government to carve off a section of American Samoa so we can have our own independent polity there, right? We would get laughed at. The fact that Herzl was able to achieve this, it actually is a victory. But that's why it was a victory. But the reason why it was not a victory is because he basically, this is what in halacha what we call Exer Sheina Tzibur Yachol Lamad Bo. He came up with a plan. He came up with an idea that people wouldn't swallow. So he presents it for a vote, not on the plan, but on whether or not to send a delegation as a fact-finding mission to the territory that Britain has designated, and a whole hullabaloo breaks loose in the Sixth Zionist Congress. Jabotinsky in the Zionist Congress is there, and he's entranced. He's sitting there, mouth open wide, and he discovers himself, and he sees all of a sudden this ideology and this goal and this meaningful pursuit that his eyes are opened, and he talks in retrospectively. He talks about meeting Herzl at this thing at the Sixth Zionist Congress, and he speaks to him in messianic terms. which is how a lot of people spoke about him, but it's particularly noteworthy for Jabotinsky, because this is a guy that didn't talk about people that way. The only other person that he ever spoke with that much reverence is Joseph Trumpeldor, who we'll get to in 1 minute. So basically what happens is, right, he's coming here as a well-paid journalist working in Odessa, and he basically gives it up overnight, and now he takes on full force the cause of Zionism. Jabotinsky goes from here to, it's interesting that he voted against the plan. Again, the plan was to send representatives to Uganda, to what really is in Kenya, on the shore of the Great Bitter Lake. But he votes against it, and then there was a staged walkout after the vote. All the people that voted against it, there was a huge percentage. Herzl thought he was gonna have a slam dunk with this vote, because again, it wasn't a vote on the actual topic. He was hoping to just pacify everyone. And a huge 150 delegates at the Sixth Zionist Congress vote against it, and then they stage a walkout. And Jabotinsky goes out with him. Herzl then follows these people out as they're caucusing outside of in a different room at this Congress. And Herzl then goes in there and he basically takes command of this, and he placates them and he gets everybody to come back. So Jabotinsky was there in the room when this was happening. And he talks about how, and this is again probably some of the immaturity factor of it, he talks about how he was swept up by the idea of it. And even in retrospect, he couldn't really give you a good answer as to why he voted against it or why he walked out. Okay, so but from this point on, from the Sixth Zionist Congress on, he is now a complete convert. He drinks the Kool-Aid to the cause of Zionism, and he drops his position in the paper in Odessa, and then he ends up taking a job in St. Petersburg, right, which is the capital of Russia. He takes a job in St. Petersburg as a working for a Zionist newspaper, but in the same area, but he's exclusively working writing on this particular political topic. Okay, and that ends up occupying him for a long time. Okay, what's going on in the world at this point? 1905, the Russian Revolution leads to democratic elections for the Russian Duma, and the Zionist Party, right, this is the Russian Duma is the Russian parliament. The Zionists in Russia actually declare a political party, a Russian political party of Zionists, and they actually win seats. Fascinating. A very small number of seats, but they actually win seats. So this is a nascent political movement that's even gaining traction in Russia, in the Russian parliament. So it's obviously on the rise. 1907, he marries what really was his high school sweetheart from Odessa, Anya Gelperin, and shortly thereafter they have their only child, who's a kid named Ari Jabotinsky. Ari Jabotinsky, we don't really have time to speak about him, but Ari ends up serving in the first Knesset in the elections of 1949. He was a Chaver Knesset. Jabotinsky dies in 1940, so he misses the Hakamat Amdina, and Ari Jabotinsky, his son, ends up serving in the first Knesset. But that was the end of his political career. Not surprisingly, he was a brilliant. A brilliant electrical engineer. He got his PhD from Hebrew U, and then went on to do some brainy science stuff that I couldn't tell you what it was. So Jabotinsky now is working still in journalism, but working in for the Zionist cause. His first early years in Zionism really are just as a journalist. He takes up the cause, and he's obviously a magnificent, very, very talented communicator. The people that heard him speak in that era talk about what a masterful, powerful, impactful, and just effective speaker that he was. He knew how to communicate. He knew the power of language. And that's what he was using to sell the cause of Zionism to the world. It was in the process of doing this that he moves around in a whole bunch of different places, working in journalism, and eventually decides that what he needs to be able to do in order to contribute to the state more is to get his law degree. So he finally, eventually, after a few years of this, he goes in 1910 to Yaroslavl, which is, again, it's on here also, and that's where he actually does, for the first time in his life, go to school and go to class and do well, not surprisingly, and he graduates with a law degree. He practices law. He ends up practicing law for about a half hour of his life, or for one afternoon of his life, in which when he ends up being a soldier at the next stage of his career. There was somebody that was court-martialed, and he ends up defending one of his soldiers who was court-martialed, and he realizes at the time that that's the only time he ever made any use of his legal training. But be that as it may, he was trained in law, as were, it's not to be lost on us, almost all of the founding fathers were trained in law. Begin was, Ben-Gurion was, Yitzhak Ben-Tzvi was. The people who were trying to establish the legal basis, the legal groundwork for establishing a new state, for establishing a new political entity, these are people all with legal training. Alan Dershowitz, I remember watching this and something that he once said. He said that Israel has one of the most authentic birth certificates of any nation in the world. And one of the reasons why is because the people that forged, you know, the people that wrote, that created its birth certificate were people that were masters of the law. Okay. So that's, so after 1912, he's finishes law school, and one of the next really interesting things, now he's by this point a pretty well-known person. He's a prolific writer, he's a prolific journalist, and now he's an outspoken leader in the Zionist cause. He ends up getting put on the committee that's originally there for, that's originally appointed to plan for this idea to have a new Hebrew university in Yerushalayim. And he's on the planning committee. And this is actually one of the places where we can see his first ideological divide with some of his comrades. There were the Weizmann and the like, Chaim Weizmann, who we'll have a chance to speak about in a couple of weeks. So Chaim Weizmann was of the opinion that we need to start small, and we needed to make sure that it's the most qualitative piece type of educational institution as possible. And he and Jabotinsky was of the mind that no, we need to build big. I don't care if it's if the quality suffers at the beginning stages, but let's just build as big of an institution as we can with as many departments as we can. Bring in students, bring in people, bring in professors. We want to cull talent. We want the brilliant Jews that are out in the world. We want them to have as much of an opportunity to be able to teach as we can. But at the same time, he was actually the one who of the two, he probably would probably consider him to be the more practical of, you know, in terms of the poles, which sometimes get blurred anyway. Okay, so that's in 1913. He's continuing to work in this capacity. And in 1908, I should mention before, 1908 is the first time that he visits Palestine, and he writes of that trip of looking at untilled land and uncultivated land, talking about, you know, the tragedy of how the Jews have not, you know, come to claim their land and that kind of thing. All important stages. 1914, World War I breaks out, and this is probably the most important stage. And we'll finish with this. I'll just say two sentences about post World War I. So World War I breaks out in 1914. We know the story. It's one of the important stories in human history. All of a sudden, we had a bunch of countries who, for the most part, had been not warring with each other for 100 years since Napoleon's armies were defeated 100 years earlier. Now, the scary thing about World War I was that the warfare had changed to such a degree, the technology that had developed to such a degree, that people were capable of mass destruction in a way they never had. A warplane, bombs, didn't exist before. 100 years earlier, the last time we had a world war, multiple countries at each other's throats, we were still using muskets and bayonets. And now, all of a sudden, we had tanks, we had planes, we had bombs, we had chemical weapons. That was actually Weizmann's contribution to the British war effort, was that he was a chemist, and he developed chemical weapons for the British Army, which actually earned him a good positive reputation, which did a lot for Zionism as well. So he's in St. Petersburg at the outbreak of World War I. Now, World War I, you remember, Russia's now entangled in this, and they're fighting Germany. At the time, he was working and coordinating with the Zionist executive, whose office was in Berlin. At the start of World War I. Now basically what happens is his entire Zionist activity gets completely stunted because he doesn't have the opportunity to work anymore because the office that he was working for and with and being directed by was in an enemy capital, and he's in St. Petersburg, and he's a native Russian. So he can't really get to Berlin, and if he got to Berlin, he probably would be put in jail, he wouldn't be allowed in. So he basically has no choice but to stop his Zionist activity. So what does he do? He ends up taking a job as a war correspondent for a paper back in Odessa. He calls up the paper in Odessa and he says, why don't you pay me and I'll go be your war correspondent and I'll go to the front lines. That is when, all right, and this is where everything gets, you know, it kind of just balloons, and it's amazing. That is when, in the process of covering the war, he winds up in, it's really all a cover, and he wants to make it to Alexandria. Because Alexandria was on the front with Palestine, and that's the area that he wants to cover. And he gets there, and the scene that he sees is fascinating. Again, think of it, Ottoman Palestine is on one side, and British-controlled Egypt is on the other. Alexandria is in Egypt. Again, so you can check the map. So Alexandria is in Egypt, and now he's on the border with the battle lines for World War I, and he sees a camp, basically a refugee camp of 6,000 Palestinian Jews, right? 6,000 residents of Eretz Yisrael who were kicked out of Ottoman Palestine by the Ottoman Empire because they weren't native Ottomans. They were only like first generation immigrants, and they said either become Ottoman citizens or get out, or you're going to get punished. So 6,000 refugees there. That is when it's at this point that the uh, that Jabotinsky meets a young soldier who is a veteran. Not, he's not that young. He's a soldier about his age, who's in general older than most of the people that are in Alexandria. A young soldier by the name of Joseph Trumpledore. Joseph Trumpledore was a veteran of the Russian army in the Russo-Japanese War. He was actually a decorated war veteran. He was the highest ranking, I'm assuming that this is not no longer the case, but then he was the highest ranking Jew in the Russian army in its history. Nobody had ever achieved a higher rank, because he was a decorated war veteran, and he actually lost an arm in the Russo-Japanese War years earlier. So now, Trumpledore is there. Trumpledore is a very, very proud Jew. There's all these stories. Once he was an officer in the Russian army, they told him that, you know, that now we're in revolutionary Russia. They told him he's not allowed to be a Jew anymore. He's not allowed to even be religious anymore. And he specifically retired from the Russian army and moved into out in the boonies, where he could raise his children as Jews, and nobody would bother him. Right? He wasn't sitting and learning Daf Yomi, but he was a very, very proud Jew that identified with it. So Trumpledore meets Jabotinsky. Right? Jabotinsky obviously makes an impression. He's this big, powerful guy, and he's missing an arm, and he's a decorated war veteran. Trumpledore gives Jabotinsky this idea of starting a Jewish army. All right, and what's the plan? And this is very simple, but it's brilliant. Everything changes once the Ottoman Empire starts to get into World War I. Because they say, okay, their chances are, Jabotinsky was sure from day one that they were going to lose the war. That the Ottomans were going to lose the war. And because they were going to lose the war, they were going to lose their territory. Now that the Ottomans are going to lose their territory, we have the best chance that we'll ever have to actually grasp, to seize the land, to seize our ancestral homeland, because it's going to be a point at which nobody has jurisdiction over it, because the Ottomans are going to lose it. So what do we need to do? We need to ingratiate ourselves to the British Empire, who are going to be the dominant power. This is so prescient. We're going to need to ingratiate ourselves to the British Empire, who are going to be the victorious power in World War I, and through that, they're going to be into Zionism that much more. So the original plan falls on deaf ears. Everybody wants to laugh at him. He comes up with this plan with Trumpledore, and they present it to the general who's in charge of the Egyptian force, the British Egyptian forces. What we want to do is we want to draw from the 6,000 refugees a Jewish army, and we will be on the front lines charging against the Ottomans in Palestine. We're going to lead the charge, and after we wallop them, we're going to be the ones that are going to be the occupying military force that are going to be in charge of security. So this was a way of not only becoming a part of the victory, fighting and bleeding and dying and sacrificing for the liberation of the land of Israel, but also ingratiating themselves to the British, and through that, the British are now going to owe them a big one. The Arabs, Arab residents of Egypt didn't offer to do this. It was only the Jews. So they're going to owe them one, and they're not going to have the chutzpah to refuse the Jews. So this is the plan that he has. They go over, they approach the general and the commander of the forces, of the Egyptian forces in Alexandria at the time, Trumpledore, who's a decorated veteran, and Jabotinsky, with this idea, and he basically laughs them out of his room. And but then he comes back to them and he says, no, I have a good plan. Instead of, you're not citizens of the, British citizens, you're not British subjects. So what we can do, though, is you can join the Mule Corps. The Mule Corps, which ended up becoming known as the Zion Mule Corps. This is fascinating. The offer that was made to them was that there was a huge amount of animal transportation that was used to haul gear in this war. So you come with your Jewish legion, right? Come with your Jewish soldiers, and you guys will be in charge of transporting all of the gear once we get off of our warships and we need to go overland. Jabotinsky is disgusted by this idea. He's all about the idea of Jewish pride and of establishing this in a way that the world is going to look at the Jews differently. And all they're asking us to do is to drive donkeys and drive mules. So he doesn't like this plan. Trumpledore does it, though, and Trumpledore ends up doing it. They gather a force of 600-700 soldiers, and they end up seeing this very significant, valiant action in Gallipoli, in the Battle of Gallipoli, which ends up being a lost battle, a lost front in World War I. But they participated with honor and with valor, and they earned the respect and the admiration of the British forces. That's what Trumpledore does. He gathers these forces from the 6,000 refugees that are in Alexandria. What Jabotinsky, while that's going on, he, for the first time in his life, goes to London. And he says, I got to go to the center of power, and I got to sell this idea to the center of power. So he goes to London, he tries to make some connections, he fizzles out, it doesn't work very well, and ends up going back to being a war correspondent, because this plan of his to make a Jewish army completely fizzles. And then a couple of years later, Trumpledore shows up with his veterans, with his veterans at the Battle of Gallipoli into England. And once he had that, you know, he had that gravitas, they couldn't say no to them. So that was basically when they got permission. That's when Jabotinsky and Trumbledore got permission to actually train in non-subjects of the British Empire. I mean, this stuff is fast. I wish I had the pictures to show you. There are pictures of these people marching down the streets in London and everybody on their kosher butcher shop. They actually marched through Jewish London after they established this legion. It was known as the Jewish Legion. It was the 38th London Regiment. And they were training with the goal of exactly what Jabotinsky wanted to do. Join the forces in Palestine and actually be on the front lines, charging against the Ottomans and conquering Palestine, conquering Eretz Israel for the Jewish people. It gives me chills and goosebumps just thinking about the plan and what it might have been. The problem is, by the time all the training and everything happened, they had hundreds of soldiers. Jabotinsky is actually appointed as an officer in this process. He was commissioned as an officer, and then promoted as an officer, and I forget the rank that he is in, but he's promoted right before they're about to go to leave for Palestine. And I believe to this day, he remains one of only two people in the history of Britain, which is a very long history, in the history of the British Empire, to be a non-British subject who becomes an officer in the British Army. Fascinating. And it's all because of his political know-how and his ability to finagle situations and do all this. He gets through this process. They finally get to Palestine. Not only that, but they're joined by two other battalions, one of which is Jewish Legion battalions, one of which is made of Jewish residents of Palestine, and the other one, which is actually recruits, European and American recruits. This is a fascinating story. I never knew this until I was an adult and I started reading about it. American and European recruits who were refugees in America that trained in Nova Scotia. All right, this was the British. It was a British territory. It trained in Nova Scotia. These are American and Canadian Jews that actually went. Not many, but there were American and Canadian Jews that actually went to train in Nova Scotia to fight in World War I for the British Army to liberate Palestine. Three battalions show up: the 38th, the 39th, and the 40th. This is what became known as the Jewish Legion of the Royal Fusiliers, and they go to Palestine. And the tragedy of the story, and it's not a tragedy, but the sad part of the story is they end up being about 3 months too late, because the main offensives that took place in the liberation of Palestine already took place, and they end up taking part in a few semi-important battles, but nowhere near the cavalry charging that Jabotinsky had always envisioned. And because of that, you always have to think what might have been. If the military heroes of the conquest of Palestine in World War I were these three battalions of Jewish soldiers, who knows what might have been? Who knows what debt the British Empire might have felt towards them? Be that as it may, they still did feel that. And in the November of 1917, the Balfour Declaration is issued. Right? I have the photostat of the original paper. It's a very fascinating, legal and historical topic, which you don't have time, but basically the Balfour Declaration recognizes the Jewish right. The more I read of this history, the more I can't imagine, considering how high up this decision went to make this Jewish battalion, I can't imagine that this didn't have a really significant impact on the decision of the British Empire to issue this declaration and to establish a commitment of Jewish settlement and creating a Jewish national home in Palestine. I can't picture how that was not a really significant factor. Okay, so we'll finish up. World War I ends up ending only a few weeks after the Jewish Legion arrives, and their role ends up being about managing the military occupation, but not in places that they wanted to. And it really only lasts for a few months. Jabotinsky's bored out of his wits. He ends up getting court-martialed. That's when he was a lawyer for one afternoon. It's because his soldiers are court-martialed also. And his career as a soldier ends up being not so fruitful and nowhere near the success that it was hoping to be. This is Jabotinsky in his army uniform, in his British Army uniform. So after World War I, the post-war period of the cleanup, right, of all the countries ends up happening, and that was when Wilson came along, and Dr. Katz can regale us for quite some time about this. Wilson came in with his 14 points about reconstruction of the world and the creation of the League of Nations, which is the forerunner of the United Nations. The same idea of a conglomerate of nations creating some type of political entity, and that was part of their job. The League of Nations' job was to figure out how to parcel out all of the land that came together. Okay, we're going to end with this because we don't really have time to finish the rest of this history. But this is the first page of the Mandate of Palestine. This is one of the things that the League of Nations decided. The original plan that was agreed between Britain and France, and what was known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. That's this map next to the Balfour Declaration. This red area was supposed to be an independent Iraq that was a British protectorate. This purple area was supposed to be the British mandate, and this green and blue area was supposed to be the French areas of rule. So that was what the plan was. In the end of the day, the entire area of what we have as known as Eretz Israel ends up being called the British Mandate, and the 3-4 area plan doesn't end up of the Sykes-Picot Agreement doesn't end up going into play. This shape over here is the original British Mandate as determined by the League of Nations. Okay, this is very important. We're going to finish with this. If anybody ever looks at the images, and Ben, we saw this in the shul that we davened in over in the shul that Ben's grandmother, Alei HaShalom, that she had a really important role in. This image of this particular piece of territory was the original mandate for Palestine. If you read through the it was also on the original sheet, some excerpts. If you read through the original document of the mandate of Palestine, the entire mandate was supposed to be the Jewish national home. Now, if you look at the population of the Jewish population of Europe at this time, the plan was to flood. There were 750,000 Arabs in what was then Ottoman Palestine, now British Palestine. The plan was to flood the country with 2-3 million Jews, right? All of whom want to leave anyway. And once we were going to do that, once we flooded with 3 million Jews, nobody ever wants the Arabs to go anywhere. They're going to stay where they are. They're just going to be a minority in a Jewish country. That'll be fine. Nobody's going to have any problem with that. And it was going to be on a territory that was quadruple the size of what ended up becoming the modern-day state of Israel. This plan starts getting undone piece by piece, starting in 1922 with the 1922 White Paper, and that's when the dividing line ends up being for the Jordan River, and everything to the east of the Jordan River becomes Transjordan, and that's something that we recognize. Now, Jabotinsky argued for the rest of his life that the undoing of the British Mandate was illegal, it was unethical, and it was wrong. And that's why the ideological grandchildren of Jabotinsky's movement, which it's a tragedy that we're talking about, and we didn't even really get a chance to talk about Beitar and the revisionist movement that the last 20 years of his life are what he is most known for. But I think that the beginning part is the most interesting. But the symbol of his ideological grandchildren are always claiming that the undoing of the original British mandate, which was eventually supposed to be the entire Jewish state, is completely wrong, illegal, and unfair. And it was going against promises being made, agreements that were signed. And that's why, if you look at the logos that the Eitzel and Lehi, the Irgun Tzvai Lumi, and the Lochamei Chirut Yisrael, which were the Jewish underground that were the ideological children of Jabotinsky that fought in his name, they use this image as their emblem. They still use this image as their emblem. Still today, you can see this image. Do a Google image search of Lehi or Eitzel, and you're going to see this image. So, yeah, and they were scratching it into the walls, right? And they were right. That image. That's what you saw. Okay, the end of Jabotinsky's life is really significant. He ends up taking this ideology that he has, which we really didn't even get into so much as we were doing his history, of a Jewish pride and a practical approach to Zionism, doing what works, as opposed to a bottom up or top down ideological one and trying to entreat. He wanted to stick to his guns, and that, I guess to some degree is what's reminiscent of the Israeli right today. But I think it's a gross oversimplification. Jabotinsky ends up in 1930 getting exiled from British Palestine because he continues his work as a journalist, and they end up deciding that he's inciting Arab rioting, and rather than punishing the Arab rioters, which they did also, but rather than holding them accountable for just responding to words, they hold accountable the person that's making the words, and he's exiled. In the last 10 years of his life, he's actually barred from Israel. Jabotinsky does a lot of fundraising because he ends up starting a political movement, which was known as the Revisionist Zionists, and they were gaining momentum, and he's in America in 1940 on a fundraising tour. He went to visit America several times, and in that process he was old and unwell. He wasn't that old. He was 60. He was unwell, and he died of heart failure on Long Island. Not far from here. And he was buried in Montefiore Cemetery. In 1940, he was buried in Montefiore Cemetery. There was a whole big delegation. I had was one of the pictures that is not on here. a whole big delegation of people that came to visit. You know, his soldiers came to America, and Israeli politicians were visiting. Ben-Gurion and he didn't get along. We didn't have a chance to talk about that much. But Ben-Gurion, who was the prime minister for the first 15 years of the country, wouldn't allow him to be reinterred. He put it in his will, Jabotinsky put it in his will, that the only way that he will be reinterred will be under a Jewish government governing Palestine. And even though that was established only 8 years after his death, Ben-Gurion refused to allow him, and what ends up happening is that it takes until, because Ben-Gurion was such a bitter political enemy, he wouldn't allow it. It wasn't until Ben-Gurion stepped down and Levi Eshkol takes over as the third prime minister of Israel that in the 1963, I believe, Jabotinsky's remains were exhumed and they were buried in Har Herzl. Now he has a matzeva in Har Herzl, which does honor to his real lifelong efforts on behalf of the Jewish people, and on behalf of the state of Israel, and all the efforts that he put towards its birth. I would argue, like I said before, I would argue that the amount that he did just in terms of the Jewish Legion and the effort that he put in doing it, I don't know if the Balfour Declaration ever happens if it's not for that. And if it's not for the Balfour Declaration, I don't know if the League of Nations mandate ever happens. If it's not for the League of Nations mandate ever happens, who's to say whether we have any meaningful immigration pre or post World War II to Eretz Yisrael? And I think that Jabotinsky belongs on the Mount Rushmore, right up there with everybody else, because of his efforts, and also because I think it's important to note that he was a check on a lot of the other ideological differences that he had with people. And he, you know, any time that you have somebody who's ideologically warring with you, it forces you to stick to your guns. Yeah. Trumbledore is buried also in Har Herzl. He was killed in Tel Chai, which was I think he's buried in Har Herzl. I don't think he's buried up north. It's a whole other story. Beitar was named out. His youth movement that he starts like a Bnei Akiva for that's supposed to be his idea, you know, following his ideology. And in that process, this youth movement, he does it to honor Trumbledore. Trumbledore, whom he never knew well. He never spent significant time with, but to him, he was the paragon of Jewish strength and Jewish bravery and, you know, commitment to a cause. So he honors Trumbledore for the rest of his life, always looks at him in a way that he really never looked at anyone else other than Herzl. And and like I said, I think that his efforts, when you actually take a look at the history, not just on his ideology, but on the history of what he contributed, are something that are, you know, to a certain degree unparalleled. But Bezrat Hashem, we're going to look at the other side of the coin next week, and we're going to look at his ideological foe, David Ben-Gurion, of course, the much more famous and known as we know him as the first prime minister of Israel, but he actually immigrated to Palestine in the first decade of the 20th century, and his story is a fascinating one as well. Yeshkoach, everybody, thank you so much for coming.